part of the session before the break is the other Feynman Prize winner. This is the experimental one, and it'll be given by Christian Schaffmeister from University of Pittsburgh. And he's going to tell us about the work he did that got the prize.
Yeah, I'm good.
I don't have a title.
I don't have a title up either.
You actually got slightly shorter on time. I think
he's been trying to negotiate with this guy.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi. So what I'm going to tell you about is the work that we've done over the last 5 years. And first of all, I'd like to thank the Foresight Prize Selection Committee for giving me this honor, and it is quite an honor. What I'm going to tell you about is the stuff that we've done over the last 5 years, the work in my lab at the University of Pittsburgh, and let me just get started on that. Okay, so what I think about every day is how do we get from where we are right now, which I represent by this Aldrich Chemical Catalog, all the sort of tens of thousands of compounds that you can buy right now and have delivered into your lab, to sophisticated nanotechnology. What I'm really concerned about is what is this, these gears and machines, what are they made out of? How are we going to make molecular machines that can assemble productive, make products for people? So what I think about is how do we get across this this gulf here? How do we get, what is the path here? Now, machines are made out of parts. And human machines, this is a transmission from a Volvo. It's made out of lots and lots of little parts that are made out of metal and ceramics and plastics and stuff. Biological machines, this is a bacterial flagellum, are also made out of parts. And biological machines, the parts are proteins. Now, and the sort of size of these parts are on the order of 1 to 10 nanometers and 10 to 100,000 Daltons. Proteins are wonderful things. They're amazing things. They're versatile. They're powerful. 20 amino acids and a couple of cofactors, and put them together in one way, you make a photosynthetic engine that can convert light into chemical energy. You make channels that can selectively filter out glycerol from all sorts of other things. You make antibacterial agents. You make molecules that can synthesize other molecules. And you make molecules that can manipulate big molecules like DNA. I mean, they're amazingly versatile. What I find about them is that they're incredibly frustrating to engineer. And I know a little bit about this because I've done protein engineering. My background is actually in biophysics. As a graduate student just down the street, up the street here at the University of California in San Francisco, I designed, built, and expressed and synthesized a four-helix bundle protein. It's one of the largest proteins that's been sort of designed from first principles. It took me 4 years, and it's a molecular doorstop. It doesn't do anything. And after this, I got very frustrated because I knew how to make this, but I don't know how to make any other ones. And apologies to Steve, whose stuff I absolutely love. I'm amazed at how far protein design, rational protein design, has come in the last 10 years. But at the end of my graduate career, I was kind of frustrated with this, and I thought, I should start over. I'm going to start from scratch again. I look over and I see chemists making all these wonderful things, these huge natural products, making amazing molecules. They can make almost anything they want. And I saw all these people making different building blocks. And I thought, I can do that. What if we design building blocks that are easier to design macromolecules with? And what if we could synthesize them and maybe make macromolecules faster than we can using amino acids, using proteins? So this is a very good review that just touches, this picture just touches on the field. There's a very good review here, but lots of people make different building blocks that when they assemble them together into chains, they can fold and form new three-dimensional structures. Okay, that's the basic idea of what I decided to get into. Okay, but the difference between what we do and what everyone else does, including nature and everyone else makes building blocks that they connect together through a single bond, and they make oligomers with these molecules with multiple building blocks that then have to fold into some three-dimensional structure to become functional. To make a molecular device, they have to fold. And that folding problem is something that we don't understand very well. So what I came up with was, what if we make building blocks that, instead of connecting together through a single bond, connect together through pairs of bonds? And then when you make oligomers, you'll make ladder molecules. You'll make stiff ladder molecules, and maybe we can control the shape by controlling the shape of the building blocks. So that's the basic idea. So what we're doing in my lab is we're developing a small collection of building blocks with different shapes, but they all connect together in the same way. And when we assemble them in different sequences, we'll be able to make different three-dimensional structures. That's the goal. And then we can use these to present functionality in three-dimensional space to achieve function, to make catalysts and sensors and building blocks like bricks that can attach to other bricks to make larger structures. That's the long-term goal here. Okay, so that's all cartoons. Here's what we've actually done. We can now synthesize all four of these building blocks. These are our first ones. And what these are, we call them bis amino acids because they have two amino acid groups in them. They have an amino acid on one side, an amino ester on the other side. This is an ester. And then the amines have two different protecting groups on them, and those protecting groups we can take off independently. Each building block has at least two stereocenters, here at the 2 position and the 4 position. And that just means that here in this one, this carboxylic acid is coming out towards you, and down here, it's going into the board. Okay, it's just a matter of shape. And then at this stereocenter here, this nitrogen is coming out towards you, and then in this case here, it's going into the board. And we label, in organic chemistry, we label these as S and R, S and S, or S and R stereochemistry, and that's what this name means. The Pro-4 means it's derived from 4-hydroxyproline. It's just the name that we've given it. And then the 2S, 4S represents the stereochemistry at the 2 position. But these four building blocks we can now make in the lab. I'm not going to go through this, but I just want to tell you, we make it from stuff we buy from Aldrich. We start with a compound called 4-hydroxyproline. It's in our cartilage. It's a modified proline amino acid. It's cheap. It's $1.50 a gram. You get it from extract that you hydrolyze and extract chicken feathers, and that's where it comes from. So we start with this stuff. It's stereochemically pure, and we modify it through a series of steps to make the completed building block. It takes about 1.5 weeks to go through this process. And in the synthesis, we actually generate a new stereocenter. We start with 2 here, but we destroy one of them in this second step. And then in this step of the reaction, we convert this ketone into these 5-membered rings. These are called hydantoins. And we generate a new stereocenter in this position. So we generate a mixture of 2 compounds. We can separate these compounds using a technique called chromatography into 2 different bottles. And we'll take one of them, run it through the last steps, and have the completed building block. To make one of the other shapes, like the SR, we take the minor diastereomer from that previous synthesis that we separate out, and we run it through the same last steps, and we make this building block. And then to make the mirror image compounds, we start with 4-hydroxyproline. We flip this stereocenter using a published procedure, recrystallize it. We can do this on 20, 30 grams at a time in the lab. And then we take this form, we run it through the same synthesis, and we make 2 more building blocks. Okay, it's pedestrian chemistry. It takes about 1.5 to 2 weeks to bring 10 grams of the material through. That's sort of what we do now. Okay, so we make all these building blocks, but they're absolutely stereochemically pure, and we have them in separate bottles in the lab. So what we do with them then is we put them back together again. We take a standard peptide synthesis resin that you can buy from Nova Biochem. It's a plastic beads with free nitrogens, free amines on them. And we'll take one of the building blocks and we'll activate it with an activating group and then couple it to the resin. So we make a new amide bond here. Then we take off this protecting group, off this amine, and we reveal a new amine, a new nitrogen. Then we bring in another building block and we couple it to here. Okay, to get from having one building block to having 2 building blocks on takes about 1.5 hours in the lab. So then we take off its FMOC group, we couple another one, now we have 3 building blocks, and I'll stop there because I run out of space, but we can couple whatever we want to this end, we can put whatever we want to that end by putting it on the resin first. And after we've made a chain, you know, 3 to 10 to 20 to ultimately 50 building blocks, we cleave it from the resin with a little bit of acid and we get a flexible molecule. Okay, nothing really new, we're just using our weird building blocks. It's standard peptide chemistry. Merrifield won the Nobel Prize in the 60s for developing what I just showed you with regular amino acids. Okay, so we take this flexible molecule now, and we strip off this protecting group that's on every building block, and we reveal another amine. Now comes the new thing. We dissolve this up in a catalytic solution, and what happens is this nitrogen attacks that methyl ester, this nitrogen attacks that methyl ester. Normally, these things don't attack each other in solution, but because they're held so close to each other, the reaction is actually pretty fast. It takes about 1 hour half-life at room temperature. So we just let it sit for 2 days on the benchtop, and it zips up another amide bond between every adjacent pair of building blocks. Now we have something new. We have a stiff molecule that has no rotatable bonds from here to here, and its shape is defined by the stereocenters in the molecule. We can control every stereocenter. Okay, so with three building blocks, we can make 4 × 4 × 4 different molecules with different stereochemistries. Okay, here's how that works. So here's a 5-mer that we made. We put a diazole group on one end, a naphthalalanine amino acid. You know, we can put whatever we want on the ends. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 building blocks. We've cleaved it from the resin and taken off those second protecting groups. Now we dissolve it in a catalytic solution and we let it sit and it closes up. Here's how it goes. We cleave this from the resin and unpurified material. This is what the HPLC trace looks like, okay? It separates out all the components that are in there. And there's really just one major component, and that is this molecule. You inject it into the HPLC after 3 hours, and you get all these other peaks. These are all different compounds where you've closed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 diketopiperazines, 5 of these rings, in different combinations. Then you let it sit for another 29 hours. You inject it again. All this stuff is gone, and now you have one major peak, which is this product. It's all zipped up. Okay, so we've made a rigid molecule. We do have two little peaks that have the same mass as this, but what we think they are is epimers, where you flip one of these stereocenters. But they're small contaminants, so we've actually figured out now how to completely eliminate those. Okay, but this is our older approach. Okay, so what we've been doing over the last 5 years is developing these building block syntheses, figuring out how to put them together, and making short sequences to see if they look like what we predict they'd look like. So if you make a sequence that's got just SSSSSSSS stereochemistry in it, and you put a naphthalalanine on it, and the reason why we do this is because if we don't stick something greasy on the molecule, it's so water-soluble that we can't even purify it. It won't stick to a reverse phase column. We can't purify it. It's so water-soluble. And that's a wonderful property for these things because they're compatible with biology. So if we make a model of this thing, we get a very sort of a rod, and then we determine the structure of this using a technique called nuclear magnetic resonance, and what these all colored lines are that faded in, they represent where with the NMR data, it shows us that two protons on the molecule are very close together. And the NMR data is perfectly consistent with this structure. If you flip even one of these rings here, okay, we have a lot of rings, if you flip one of them, you'll get a different shape, but it won't be compatible with the NMR data anymore. Okay, so the NMR data is consistent with this structure. So we think we have confident that we know what the structure of that molecule is. So here's a case where we made an SSRR-SSRR sequence. Now instead of making this little rod, it makes a turn. Okay, it makes a kind of a U shape. And again, we solved the NMR structure of that, and again, it was perfectly consistent with the structure. So we're developing confidence that we can predict the structure of these molecules. Okay, but one problem with this NMR approach is that it tells us a lot about very local distances, but it doesn't say anything really about the global shape. Okay, because if I take a sequence that's SSRR, SSRR, SS, for instance, I can make depending on what molecular mechanics force field I use, I can get a prediction that says it's going to make a ring like this, or it's going to make a bow shape like that. Okay. This is very interesting to me because now we'd have a pocket and maybe we could bind things inside of there and start to make receptors and sensors. This we could do other things with, but we probably couldn't bind small molecules to it. So we did that experiment. We made four molecules, one where we have a fluorescent donor and acceptor on one end, but they're very linked very close to each other. Then we made another one with no donor and just an acceptor. Then we made a sequence where it's all SSSSSSSSS all the way up. So that should make a rod about 20, 22 angstroms long. And we put a fluorescent donor and acceptor on the ends. And then we made a sequence that's SSRRSSRRSS and a donor acceptor. Now, using a technique called fluorescence resonance energy transfer, we can irradiate the donor and look at how much energy transfers to the acceptor. The further away they are, the less the transfer. So here, this is like 0% efficient. There's no donor, so the curve is down here. Okay, that means zero. They're infinitely far away from each other. Thank you. This one is 100% efficient. They're very close to each other, and you can't get any more efficient than this, and that's the green curve. The blue curve, which is about 22 angstroms, should show up exactly between the two, and it does. It is at about 22 angstroms. Then the red molecule comes up between the blue and the green, so it is closer, it is holding these two groups closer than it is here. But when you actually measure the distance by fitting it to curves other people have, sort of standard curves people have developed, it's only about 1.8 nanometers across, while this is 2.2 nanometers. So this is suggesting that it's more like a bow than a ring. So, you know, frankly, I was a little bit disappointed in that, but there are applications that we can develop for this. And I'll show you one of them real quick. Okay, so we're always trying to figure out, can we control the three-dimensional structure of these things? So here we made a series of molecules where we put 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 SS building blocks together. And that should make rods of different length, okay, systematic length. And we put what are called spin probes on each end of the molecule. Okay, these are the spin probes here. And using a technique called electron spin resonance in collaboration with a brilliant colleague of mine, Sunil Saxena, he measured the EPR spectrum of these molecules, and you get a very systematic change in the EPR spectrum. When they back calculate what the distance distribution is between the spin probes, they get a beautiful linear correlation. Okay, for 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 building blocks, you can span the distance from about 2.5 nanometers to about 3.6 nanometers with almost perfect control. Okay, so we can control the end-to-end distance of these things. The molecules do get more flexible as they get longer, and you'd expect that because they just, you know, they have more ways to flex. Okay, so one of the nice things about these molecules is that it's very easy to predict the three-dimensional structures. I can... There. So what I'm doing here is I'm just iterating through different sequences and predicting the three-dimensional structure. This is way, way slowed down. It takes less than a millisecond to do, you know, basically we can do 20,000 different structure predictions per second on a little Pentium. You know, contrast that to like protein folding where you need a supercomputer like BlueGene to predict the structure of one protein and it takes a year. We can do 20,000 structures per second because they're all rigid, fused ring systems. So one application we're developing for these molecules right now is in bivalent display. So avian flu, one of the ways that you could block it is if you could bind. So there's a protein called hemagglutinin. We could apply this to hemagglutinin, but we're doing this first with cholera toxin. Cholera is a toxin is a protein that's 5 copies. It's got 5 lousy binding sites for a sugar. And people have developed multivalent versions of this where you have two sugars held together by a tether, and the idea is if you can bind one in, that the other one binds much better and you get better binding. So they've showed that they can get 4,000-fold tighter binding by putting two of these things with a very flexible tether, and that's what this looks like here, and here's the cholera toxin. So 4,000 times tighter binding than when you have a single sugar. So we're making molecules like this, and the idea is if we can make a perfect linker that could span from one binding site to another, We might get better binding because we don't have to order, we don't have to rigidify or freeze out a lot of motion of this flexible tether if we have a perfect tether. We might also get better selectivity because only proteins that have their binding sites at the distance that matches our molecule would bind our molecule. So we're making molecules like this now. My student just sent me a mail this morning saying he got it together, but I didn't have time to put it in. But here's an example of one of the molecules that we made where we wanted to just measure the distance across the ends. So I designed this sequence, 9 building blocks, a very special sequence of stereocenters, and it's designed to make this shape. So we can come bind, display one ligand here, come up, avoid a lot of protein between here, come down and present another ligand here. It should be 3.1 nanometers across. We put spin probes across the ends. It's over 2 kilodaltons in size. Here's the unpurified HPLC trace. We made the molecule. With Sunil's help, we measured the distance, and he gets 2.9 nanometers, almost exactly what we designed. So we're making a whole series of these now with the ligands on the end. A problem with these first building blocks is they really just let us make twisted sticks. They let us make these extended structures, but we want to make devices and molecules with cavities. So we've been working on making a lot of different building blocks, and we can now make all of these building blocks. We have most of them in the lab, and others are just mirror images that we can make. But we can make them all now. What these building blocks let us do is they let us make compact structures. They let us make turns. So here's an example where we synthesized this HIN building block, and we incorporated it into a sequence with one of these first Pro4, then a HIN, then a Pro4. And this little sequence, we solved its NMR structure, and we see a beautiful rosy correlation from this proton to that proton, and it says that it makes a very tight little hairpin turn. So we're using this now to make compact molecules that sort of curl back on themselves. So it's a sequence with a Pro4, HIN, Pro4, HIN, Pro4, and it should kind of make a tight turn, come up, make a tight turn down, and have a very tiny little pocket here. So this molecule, we've made it, and we're just working to make enough of it now to get an NMR structure. But here's the purified HPLC trace. This spike is this compound. It has exactly the mass that you'd expect. Okay, so some applications that we're developing for these things, I can't get into them, but we just published a paper where we're looking at chiral electrons, spin-polarized electrons tunneling through the scaffold. I told you a little bit about the polyvalent inhibitors. We could apply this to influenza. We're making receptors and looking for peptides that can bind them, and also hinged sort of receptors that could bind small molecules and change their color to make sensors for small molecules. And I wouldn't show this slide anywhere else, but I think you guys might appreciate it. The long-term goal, all of our chemistry is compatible with technology that's been developed for making gene chips. And we want to make chips that have 60,000 different molecular devices on them. And actually, this technology is called maskless array synthesis. It uses a digital light processor like it that's in the projector here to project a bitmap onto a chip and then photo deprotect pixels on there. And then you couple another building block. And with this technology, we could synthesize 60,000 different molecular devices on a chip. You know, every pixel has a different device, and you know exactly what sequence is in there. And the idea would be to synthesize arrays of different devices and then pluck them off and then assemble larger machines using mechanosynthesis sort of technology. This avoids a sort of sticky fingers problem where now we're manipulating things that are the size of small proteins that have chemical groups on them that can link up with other building blocks, and maybe we can assemble large functional molecules. So I'm not actually the person who does all this work. This is my lab. I'll tell you about them later. I probably don't have time, but the wonderful students. I have brilliant students, and they love to make molecules. And thank you very much for having me out and listening to me. Thank you.
Another excellent talk. You can see why he won the Experimental Award this year. We have time for a few questions and comments. Yes. Oh, no, we need phone, microphones. One over here. Who has a phone already? Okay,
hey.
Go ahead.
So I think that's really very interesting. I'm wondering about, have you given any thought to making branching pieces?
So that makes the synthesis a lot more complicated, given some thought to it, but protecting group chemistry gets
absolutely
exponentially more complicated the more functionality you put on the building block. We are working on making building blocks with a side chain so that we can present other functionality off of it, but not branching, because I don't know if there's enough protecting groups in existence to do that. Orthogonal protecting groups.
Yeah, okay.
Just one more.
Yeah, but
next.
Complicated, yeah.
Great talk. Two questions. Can you get crystals? And can you get an X-ray structure?
I'm a protein crystallography. I haven't figured out how to get crystals of these things yet. They're kind of in an uncomfortable size range. They're not small molecules. They're not big proteins. We've tried. We haven't hit on the... I mean, it's a bit of a black art to find conditions that will crystallize the things. We haven't been successful yet. We're much better at the NMR structures, and we're starting to use a technique called residual dipolar couplings now to get better structural information. But we're working on crystals as well.
And second question is, so do you worry that when you make longer polymers and you do the second step that zips it up, that you might get sort of non-local cross-linking?
No, I've had grant proposals rejected because people thought that might be a problem.
It wasn't me.
No. But you think it'd be a problem, but it's actually not, because there's Baldwin's rules, basically. Five-membered rings close fastest, six-membered rings close a little slower. Everything else is slower than that. So six-membered rings are really the fastest thing, and since our molecules are all set up to form six-membered rings, there are cases where we've actually activated the ester instead of having a methyl ester. We've activated it with very hot activating agents. We only get a single, and you can close up three of these rings, and you can imagine all these different permutations. We get one product out of it. Baldwin's rules work. Okay, it's a organic chemistry synthetic thing.
Do your BIS proteins denature?
No, they shouldn't. They should, because they're fused ring systems. They, we have to make more and larger, and that's where we're doing that more and more, and determine their structures and see how rigid are they? I don't expect them to denature, though, because they're fused ring systems. You should be able to heat them up to 150 degrees and cool them down, and they'll boop, they'll be right back where they were.
And they're still surviving a vacuum.
I don't see any reason why not. I mean, proteins do. These are stiff little bricks. You know, stiff on the scale of things. You know, they're not diamond, but they're not PEG. They're not polyglycine. They're somewhere in between there.
I think it was over there.
Beautiful work. I'm wondering whether your molecules could allow for self-replication.
I don't know. I think that's such an incredibly complicated problem. I'm all into controlling, making designed structures, and I don't think so. Because there's multiple steps, and I don't really worry about it because I think it's such a complex problem. Self-replication is enormously complex. It's much easier to, you know, I think we'll have sophisticated nanotechnology. We don't need self-replication for it. We just need programmable matter. We need to be able to control structure. We can synthesize, never mind. I'll answer questions. I can go on and on.
Do we have any more discussion or questions?
Speaking of the folding issue, have you taken the CD spectrum of any of these molecules?
No, not yet, because I think it's going to be complicated to map the structure to the circular dichroism spectrum.
Just to see if it should give a spectrum that's sort of non-zero, and it'd be interesting to see what those spectral features are, how they depend on temperature.
Yes, and also to make two enantiomers and take the CDs and they should be mirror images of each other. Those are basic things that we need to do. Haven't done them yet. We've been really focusing on high-resolution structural information. But there's a lot of characterization we still have to do.
Do we have some more discussion? Now let's thank this morning's speakers for a really excellent symposium.